Take back the city for yourself tonight. I'll take back the city for me. Take back the city for yourself tonight. Whoa, whoa.
Welcome to Third Paradigm, an out-of-the-box think tank about community sovereignty and regenerative economics. We look at how to take back our cities, farmland, and water, our money, production, and trade, our media, education, and culture, our religion, and even our God. We present a people's history of the Bible and a parent's view on how to raise giving kids in a taking world. I'm your host, Teresa Caraggio, broadcasting through Free Radio Santa Cruz, WHCL Hamilton College, Radio Lillooet, British Columbia, and Upstart Radio Online. Welcome to the 55th episode of Third Paradigm, thirdparadigm.org. This week, we'll be taking a closer look at AIDS. We'll start by talking about a photography book called Face to Face, Children of the AIDS Crisis in Africa, and our interview with the author, Ruth Ann Richter. Then we'll comment on a film called Angels in the Dust, which I watched with my daughters. It's about a South African couple who took their life savings and opened an orphanage that practices compassion with tough humor. When my daughters also brought home Rent from the video store, I knew there was no avoiding an episode on AIDS. It was clearly in my path. But I didn't know why. It's not my kind of issue. There's no villain, no political intrigue, no closet full of sordid details. So I started to do some research, and soon my Google searches led me to the question of whether AIDS was developed as a biological weapon. After we look at the heroic ways in which people are rising to meet the challenge of AIDS, we'll examine the evidence for whether that challenge was man-made, not an act of God or nature. Some people may call this a soup-to-nuts approach, going from care and compassion to conspiracy theories. I'm not certain myself what I believe, but I find that I learn a lot from watching someone or something's detractors. There's a formula for how to discredit someone while skirting the substance of their argument. First, you attack the person's credentials or lack thereof. Then you set them up to debate an expert whose rebuttal consists of things like, "I just can't believe that anyone would do that." They don't engage on any of the specific points, and they shift the discussion to personalities rather than research. When I saw this pattern emerging with an interview of Dr. Boyd Graves, I wanted to look at the facts myself. Another area where I recommend a deep dive into the facts is in charitable giving, with AIDS or anything else. I have a friend who asked my recommendations for his end-of-year contributions. I named three that I work with closely, and that my student group has raised funds for: the Quixote Center, Rights Action, and Grassroots International. My friend responded that Charity Navigator had given them a mere 2, 3, and 4, respectively, out of 10 stars. So I took a look at how Charity Navigator does their calculations. Their first measures are the amount spent on programs versus administration and fundraising, based on the charity's own tax reporting. If they call 10% or less of their expenses administration, they get a 10, even if 100% of their overseas aid ends up in the pockets of U.S. employees or corporations. Then, if their fundraising brings in $10 for every dollar spent, they get another 10. Commission telemarketers are good for this, or the trick of putting a nickel, a packet of seeds, an angel medallion, or a stamped return envelope in direct mail solicitations. They know how hard it is for us to throw out something useful rather than sending it back with a donation. Thirdly, there's what they call capacity. If an organization keeps over $250 million or 1 year's operating expenses in the bank, they get another automatic 10. They write, "Givers should know that other independent evaluators of charities tend not to measure a charity's capacity. Indeed, charities that maintain large reserves of assets or working capital are occasionally penalized by other evaluators. In our view, a charity's capacity is just as important as its efficiency. By showing growth and stability, charities demonstrate greater fiscal responsibility, not less, for those are the charities that will continue pursuing change in the future and will generate both short and long-term results for every dollar they receive from givers. Then, their final measure is growth. To quote, "For charities, growth means first increasing their primary revenue, which includes contributions from corporations, foundations, individuals, and government grants. Program service revenues, contracts and fees, and revenue from membership dues and fees. Second, growth means growing their programs and services. Organizations that demonstrate consistent annual growth in both primary revenue and program expenses are able to outpace inflation and thus sustain their programs year to year." So charities have to continually bring in more money year to year in order to get a good rating. No wonder the charities I support don't rank. They'd be mortified to have a year's operating expenses sitting idle when it could make the difference for people resisting a military coup. My advocacy groups live hand to mouth, but Charity Navigator doesn't rate salaries, perks, and bonuses. They don't look at how much overseas aid actually stays in the U.S. Transportation costs aren't factored in, or amounts that come from and end up in the hands of corporations. After looking at how they determine their rating system, I think I might take the inverse of it as a good sign. There's something else that the charities I support do exceptionally well. They listen. They listen to local organizers, to local farmers, to the families of the disappeared, to the victims, and to the patients. Let's hear three poems about listening. These are "Finding What You Didn't Lose" by John Fox, "Waiting in Line" by Nick Penna, and "The Winter of Listening" by David White. The music is "Song of the Stars" by Dead Can Dance from their Spirit Chaser CD. Finding What You Didn't Lose. When someone deeply listens to you, it is like holding out a dented cup you've had since childhood and watching it fill up with cold, fresh water. When it balances on top of the brim, you are understood. When it overflows and touches your skin, you are loved. When someone deeply listens to you, the room where you stay starts a new life, and the place where you wrote your first poem begins to glow in your mind's eye. It is as if gold has been discovered. When someone deeply listens to you, your bare feet are on the earth, and a beloved land that seemed distant is now at home within you. John Fox from Finding What You Didn't Lose. Waiting in Line. When you listen, you reach into dark corners and pull out your wonders. When you listen, your ideas come in and out like they were waiting in line. Your ears don't always listen. It can be your brain, your fingers, your toes. You can listen anywhere. Your mind might not want to go. If you can listen, you can find answers to questions you didn't know. If you have listened, truly listened, you don't find yourself alone. Nick Penna, Fifth Grade in Poetic Medicine by John Fox. The Winter of Listening. No one but me by the fire, my hands burning, red in the palms, while the night wind carries everything away outside. All this petty worry, while the great cloak of the sky grows dark and intense round every living thing. What is precious inside us does not care to be known by the mind in ways that diminish its presence. What we strive for in perfection is not what turns us into the lit angel we desire. What disturbs and then nourishes has everything we need. What we hate in ourselves is what we cannot know in ourselves. But what is true to the pattern does not need to be explained. Inside, everyone is a great shout of joy waiting to be born. Even with the summer so far off, I feel it grown in me, now and ready to arrive in the world. All those years, listening to those who have nothing to say. All those years forgetting how everything has its own voice to make itself heard. All those years forgetting how easily you can belong to everything simply by listening. And the slow difficulty of remembering how everything is born from an opposite and miraculous otherness. Silence and winter has led me to that otherness. So let this winter of listening be enough for the new life I must call my own. David White from the House of Belonging. That was Finding What You Didn't Lose by John Fox, Waiting in Line by Nick Penna, and The Winter of Listening by David White, to the music of Song of the Stars by Dead Can Dance. Someone who has done her share of listening is Ruth Ann Richter, the author of Face to Face, Children of the AIDS Crisis in Africa. With photographer Karen Andy, she traveled throughout Africa gathering stories of how families and communities are coping with the generation of children orphaned by AIDS. I can't describe in words how exquisite these photographs are. The vivid colors, the warm, dark skin, and bright eyes of these inquisitive kids. It's hard to imagine their faces not being captured by Karen's camera and preserved in all their innocence and laughter, tumbled together in their blue school uniforms against the orange-red dirt. The statistics, however, give a sharp contrast to the light-hearted photos. 12 million children in sub-Sahara Africa are the survivors of their parents' death from AIDS. Two-thirds of the world's HIV population, or 22 million people, live in sub-Sahara Africa, with only a fraction having access to antiretrovirals. By this year, 2010, the number of children without parents will swell to 20 million, more than the entire continent of Australia. The issue of AIDS orphans first engaged Karen in 2002 when she traveled to Nairobi's notorious slum, Kibera, to photograph youngsters. She visited a makeshift children's shelter in what had been a schoolroom. Children had been abandoned by parents no longer able to care for them. They mugged for the camera, but went to bed hungry because the shelter had run out of rice. When she came back and looked at the faces emerging in her developing tray, she knew she had to do something. She began mounting exhibits of her photographs, speaking to schools, religious, and community groups, and raising funds for grassroots organizations in Africa. On her own, she collected $70,000. But she didn't stop there. She turned to her graduate school roommate from Stanford, Ruth Ann Richter. As a medical writer, Ruth Ann had covered AIDS before it had a name, in the 1980s. She would visit with patients at Ward 86, the clinic at San Francisco's General Hospital and ground zero for the epidemic. Before we return to Africa, I'd like to take a moment to remember what it was like not so long ago. Antiretrovirals have brought AIDS into being a manageable disease. But it seems like yesterday that it was a death sentence, sometimes appealed but ineligible for parole. To honor the strength and community that was born in our society out of the tragedy of AIDS, I'd like to play a song from Rent that I found moving. This is called Will I, from the original Broadway production.
Will I lose my dignity? Will someone care? Will I wake tomorrow from this nightmare?
Someone care?
Someone care?
Will I wake tomorrow?
That was a song called Will I from the Broadway musical Rent. In Ruth Ann Richter and Karen Andy's book, Face to Face, Africa is still measuring time in moments of love, even under mountains of neglect. Ruth Ann and Karen visited hospitals filled 2 to 3 to a bed with dying patients and nothing for the doctors to give them. They saw 13-year-old girls caring for their dying mothers and younger siblings. They met children crippled by malnutrition and trauma. But they also witnessed the transformation of these children when they fell into good hands. Those of Jill Simpson, a retired nurse and children's advocate, Monica Nagumi, a community organizer and irresistible force of nature, Father Daniel Caridi, a priest-turned-AIDS activist, and grannies pressed back into service. The photographs of these grandmothers are some of the most amazing. Another grandmother pressed into service is Marion Cloetti from the Dream Out Loud documentary called Angels in the Dust. Marion was a successful Johannesburg therapist who raised 3 children. When they were grown, she and her husband decided to liquidate their savings and build Boy Carabello, a village and school that serves 550 children impacted by AIDS. As a therapist, Marion is no shrinking violet. She confronts parents and bullies them into sending their kids to school rather than keeping them home to work. At one point, she graphs out a flowchart of one man as a weapon of mass destruction, tracing the partners that he infected and moving on from them when he died. The village runs active grieving sessions and talks frankly about death, in a way very similar to the Rent Life Support Group, which is the scene in which they sing Will I. Sometimes they're talking about the deaths of their parents, and sometimes they're facing their own. The most compelling character is a little girl who looks to be about 10, but talks like an unusually mature adult. Marion encourages her to tell her story. She explains to the audience how a man, a so-called friend of the family, raped her when they were alone in the hut. Her mother refused to believe it. The girl calmly tells the audience about the superstition that having sex with a virgin will cure AIDS, and how it's created an epidemic of rape for young girls. Later in the show, she decides that she's emotionally ready to find out if she's HIV positive. But to have the test, she needs her mother's permission. In a heated scene, Marion is unable to convince the mother. The film also follows a different type of orphan. The government practice in South African national parks is to kill adult elephants to control the herd size. This is called culling. But elephants have a complex social structure, not unlike the close-knit African village before it was violently disrupted by colonialism. And so orphaned elephants grow up with gang characteristics, attacking and goring rhinos or attempting to mate with them. Elder elephants have been brought from elsewhere into the herds of adolescents in an experiment that seems to be working. The village of Boy Carabello is another experiment that's working. If you'd like to help this couple that's giving new meaning to extended family, the links are posted on our website. Now let's ask the question of whether AIDS was a deliberate technique of human culling. If true, we would be going from angels to the most craven form of evil, bioterrorism against homosexuals and non-whites to reduce their populations. In 1946, when Time magazine still did journalism, they ran an article called Science Better Than the Bomb. It reported a routine House debate on naval appropriations, in which the Navy was trying to one-up the Army for the atomic bomb. One congressman said, "We have something far more deadly than the atomic bomb. We have it today, not tomorrow, and furthermore, it's in usable shape." Another chimed in, "This nation is in possession of scientific factors which place it in an enviable position. The scientific factors at hand would result in devastation equal to, if not greater than, the atomic bomb. Remember, there are different kinds of devastation." In another 1969 House Appropriations hearing, the DOD's Biological Warfare Division requested funds to develop, through gene splicing, a new disease that would both resist and break down a victim's immune system. It was approved. In 1972, the World Health Organization published in their bulletin, "An attempt should be made to ascertain whether viruses can, in fact, exert selective effects on immune function, e.g. by affecting T-cell function as opposed to B-cell functions. The possibility should also be looked into that the immune response to the virus itself may be impaired if the infecting virus damages, more or less selectively, the cells responding to the viral antigens." Then, in the mid-70s, the WHO conducted a smallpox vaccination in Africa, including 14,000 Haitians on UN assignment to Central Africa. According to the London Times in 1987, the timing and locations of the first AIDS infections coincide exactly with the smallpox vaccine. I also read years ago about whole villages wiped out by AIDS because they'd been paid to give blood that was taken with dirty needles. At the time, this was seen as mere accident. AIDS is ethno-selective, with twice the rate of infection for blacks, Latinos, and Native Americans as whites, and death coming 2 to 3 times as swiftly. 80% of children with AIDS and 90% of infants are non-whites. In 1978, a New York City hepatitis B vaccine study called for only non-monogamous males. It gave homosexuals a different serum from heterosexuals. By 1981, 25 to 50% of the first reported AIDS cases in New York had received the 78 vaccine. By 1984, 64% of recipients had AIDS, before the Department of Justice sealed the study. The same year, the New Delhi Patriot newspaper published detailed charges about AIDS as a weapon. Soon after, the chemical leak of Bhopal Union Carbide distracted their attention. In 1999, a flowchart was found for a federal program called the Special Virus of the United States of America, 1962-78. Funded with $500 million, this is exactly what the Pentagon acknowledged to Congress that they were building, a synthetic biological agent for which no natural immunity could be acquired, designed to deplete the human immune system. In 2002, Chief of Staff Anthony Trafficante from Ohio called for an investigation. It never happened. For the past 15 years, Dr. Boyd Graves has called on the Supreme Court, Congress, the UN, and NGOs around the world to investigate. Now he plans to call on Obama. Based on Obama's past actions, I'm not holding my breath. This has been Teresa Caraggio with Third Paradigm. Thank you to Dr. Boyd Graves and to Waves Forest for the article Designer Diseases, AIDS as Biological and Psychological Warfare, published on AboveTopSecret.com. Thank you to Mike Sirocco for web production, and thanks to Skidmark Bob for sound and for finding our closing song. Bob is a searchable jukebox. Throw out any topic from Judas to AIDS and he's got a reference. This one's called AIDS is a Four-Letter Word by the TVTVs. As a broadcast advisory, it's not the only four-letter word. And as a disclaimer, I don't agree with them about shooting a politician. It wouldn't do any good. Let's hit them where it really hurts. Aim for the offshore tax havens. Thanks for listening.